It's Puerto Rican because I made it. This is how author Von Diaz opens her new book titled Coconuts and Collards, Recipes and Stories from Puerto Rico to the Deep South. Diaz was born in Puerto Rico, but she grew up in Atlanta. She taught herself to cook out of necessity, adjusting her grandmother's Puerto Rican recipes to reflect her southern surroundings. She explores the role of food in her life, how it pushed her to the edge and then brought her back from it. Coconuts and Collards is published by University Press of Florida, and I'm happy it's brought Von Diaz to our show. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
So that quote, it's Puerto Rican because I made it. What does that mean to you?
That's right. You know, I think when I thought to put that in the book, I was being a little bit sassy, right? Like I was like, well, what does it mean to be Puerto Rican? What does it mean to make Puerto Rican food? And to me, it's partly that Puerto Rican food is, in its essence, a hybrid of so many different cuisines. And so the cook then becomes the author in many ways of how the dishes come out, adding a little bit of this, adding a little bit of that, and really owning that hybridity as a kind of authenticity.
And when you, so right now you live in Brooklyn.
I do.
And do you find that your food is changing once again? So it's, you know, your grandmother's cuisine, and then in Atlanta, it became your cuisine. And now, where's it going?
Oh, absolutely. So I've lived in New York almost 10 years, and I spent the first more than half in El Barrio, or East Harlem, which is still, you know, a widely Puerto Rican neighborhood. And there, I found an incredible amount of Puerto Rican ingredients that I only ever found on the island, and I had kind of a heyday with it, you know, culantro and sofrito and all kinds of Goya products and things that that growing up, I never, ever found, certainly not a stone's throw from my house, right? And now I live in Flatbush, Brooklyn, which is a differently Caribbean neighborhood. It's largely West Indian, Haitian, Trinidadian, and Jamaican. And so now I'm getting, I think, an even clearer sense of how much Caribbean cuisines have in common, the ingredients that we share, what we might or might not adjust, what's spicy and what's not spicy, how we use coconut. And I feel like it's really expanded, I don't know, my notion of the Caribbean, not just through food, but also through culture and politics and colors.
Do you find some of those flavors creeping into your food?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I have access to sorrel. I have access to, you know, interestingly, in Puerto Rico, we eat bacalao or salt cod, and West Indians tend to use pollock or other kinds of dried fish. So sometimes I'll use those instead. And I find that we use some of the same things like culantro recao, I'll find in those grocery stores, and tamarind I find almost everywhere. So yeah, they're slowly starting to creep in.
So you mentioned a favorite cookbook of yours, Cocina Criolla, and you said that it represents an old way of eating. What do you mean by that?
So Cocina Criolla is in many ways like the joy of cooking of Puerto Rico, and it is a book that was published back in the 50s. To this day, have not met a single Puerto Rican who doesn't own it. That doesn't mean they all own it, but in my, you know, informal survey, every Puerto Rican I know has it on their shelf.
They might they cook from it?
Absolutely. It is, I think, in a lot of ways, has a lot of cultural significance. A lot of times they're handed down. You might get one as a wedding present from a family member, but it's a really iconic cookbook. And it was similarly iconic in my family. So my grandmother cooked, I don't want to say exclusively, because my grandmother was really eclectic in the way that she cooked, but she cooked a lot from that book. And when I would visit her in Puerto Rico over the summers, and when she would visit us over here in the U.S. mainland, I tasted all of these delicious, super rich, flavorful Puerto Rican dishes. And when I got to the point where I was becoming a home cook in my own right and starting to cook in my own home, it became clear that that was a place that I needed to look as well in order to understand where those flavors came from and how the combinations sort of, how I might be able to use those same flavor combinations in a more modern way that matched the way that I actually cook today.
And before you wrote this cookbook, you had another big culinary project where you were cooking your way through that cookbook.
Yeah.
So what was that like?
It was kind of Julia and Julia-esque. And I, at the beginning, what I wanted to do was two things. One, my grandmother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. She spent the last 7 or 8 years of her life experiencing dementia. And so in a lot of ways, we lost her culinarily. We lost a lot of her personality, but we lost her cooking basically entirely. And it was heartbreaking, particularly because she was just such an incredible cook that it felt like this tremendous loss. So on the one hand, I really wanted to keep that connection alive and sort of create a project that would enable me to interact with her and talk to her about something specific so that we could have conversations and I can be like, Tata, did you actually add 4 cloves of garlic or did you adjust? I see that you scribbled in the notes here. Do you remember doing that? What do you think? So that was on the one hand. And the other was that I really wanted to get to know my own culture a little better and a little differently. I grew up, as you said, I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. At the time I was growing up in Georgia, it was a very small Latino community there. And there were very few Latino ingredients available. I mean, today you can get plantains at Publix, but growing up you had to drive an hour, hour and a half to somewhere where you could get an ingredient like that, which is fairly every day to us. So in that way, it was this twofold sort of very personal family project and also a way for me to start to ask questions about where my kind of taste came from.
And then so you had grounding in those recipes. And then for this book, you really went in, you really brought them, you kind of worked your magic on them. They became very personal.
Oh, thank you.
So how did you change them?
I like to think that I have magic.
oh, it's a magical book. It really
thank
is.
You so much, Melissa. One of the most significant things that came out of the what I called the Cocina Criolla project was that about 50, 60 recipes in, because I was going to go whole hog. I was going to do just like Julie did, and I was going to cook every single recipe. About 60 in.
You were done.
Yeah, I found that the recipes were a little bit repetitive. They were incredibly heavy and they were incredibly laborious in the way that they were written originally. And so I knew that I couldn't cook that way. And so I started making adaptations here and there to the dishes that I just loved so much that I really wanted to figure out how to make them well. One example of how I did that is I have a, you know, pernil or roast pork shoulder is a super common Puerto Rican dish. So I adapted it for a pork loin, much faster, same kind of flavor profile, much leaner and easier to a certain extent, and much less time. And so I started to trim fat, trim salt, trim extraneous ingredients, trim time, wherever possible, replace ingredients that maybe weren't as bright or as flavorful as I thought they could be, or didn't do what I think is the very important work of any recipe, which is to elevate the flavor of the key ingredient, right? So I wanted, instead of these kind of very heavy, over-flavored dishes, to let ingredients shine. And then started to merge that with my Southern background.
If you've just joined us, we're talking with Vaughn Diaz, the author of Coconuts and Collards, University Press of California, of Florida, not California. So when did you first start to cook?
Ooh, when did I first start to cook? My first cooking memory was at around 7 or 8. I made pancakes, and it was really memorable to me because it was sort of my first foray into food science and sort of watching those bubbles form and then flipping and heat. But I would say that I really started to cook on a regular basis right around when I was 10 or 11. And I write in Coconuts and Collards in one of the chapters about my family's economic struggle. My parents got divorced, like so many families all over the world. And my mom was a single mom working extra jobs. I had a little sister to take care of. And so I started cooking for us, largely out of necessity.
And you write about making a blue fettuccine Alfredo for your sister.
I did, sort of a la Hook.
What made it blue?
Food coloring. Yeah, I mean, my sister was really a joy. She's 8 years younger than me. And so when I was 10, she was 2. And I just wanted to make what had become really mundane, repetitive, cheap food, because that's what we could afford. I wanted to make it fun and interesting for her. So that was just one way. And I have to tell you that I asked my sister what she remembers me cooking when she was a kid, and she always remembers that first.
Wow, even though she was only 2.
Yep.
It made an impression.
Yeah, it really did.
So you write in the book that at one point you were feeding a family of 3 on $25 a week. So what was that like to learn how to use food and to really learn how to get the most out of everything?
Yeah, so it was actually $50 a week.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's okay. It was, I think, in a lot of ways, the way that I cook now is so connected to that moment. Because ultimately, my mom was, and if I can say really quickly, hey, mom, she's listening live from Tennessee. My mom really gave me a lot of agency in the kitchen. And so I went grocery shopping with her. I learned about which ingredients worked in which way. I knew sort of my skill level and could kind of mix and match here and there. So I learned that, you know, box mashed potatoes. Potatoes on their own taste pretty much like cardboard. They don't taste like a whole lot. If you add a little bit of garlic powder, maybe a little bit of milk or some Parmesan cheese, you can make them kind of extra delicious. So I started playing with spices. I started sauteing onions to add to food and kind of reincorporating different things and making, you know, leftover casseroles sometimes and things like that.
You write in the book that food was a measure of how well your family was doing.
Yeah, absolutely. We, over the years, I mean, I'm happy to say that at least my nuclear family, my mom and my sister and I, are not in that situation at all. But I remember the small moments where I could tell that things were starting to get better. I'll never forget, I think I was about 15, and my mom brought home two big containers of Bluebell homemade vanilla ice cream. And at the time, that was a really fancy ice cream for us, and we had been eating not ice cream at all. You know, we didn't have dessert. And then she was buying chicken breasts a lot often, you know, and so we started to have these really beautiful meals as a result of the ingredients we were able to afford.
So this, it's a cookbook, but it's also a memoir. And what made you decide to kind of mix the stories with the recipes? Or for you, is it all, you know, the stories and the recipes go hand in hand?
I think the stories and the recipes go hand in hand. I feel more like a storyteller than a cook, but I guess I am a storyteller and a cook. And stories, I think, give you the opportunity to expand on what I feel like is a way that people take for granted that what we eat is just like what we like, or that what we eat is about where we come from or what our family fed us. There's so much interesting psychology and culture and history in the way that we eat, and I feel like those things really get teased out when you tell them as stories.
You write that your relationship with food has changed over the years. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Definitely. I think, you know, like a lot of kids going through struggle, when I was little, I ate to feel better. I ate was what was around. And I didn't think at all about what I ate. Whereas over the years, you know, learning about the ways that some chefs that really inspire me cook their food, learning about the history behind different ingredients, behind where things grow, the very fascinating, I think very fascinating connection that Puerto Rico and the South have in our shared African ancestry has really shifted not just what I eat, but how I eat and where I invest money. And I mean, one other thing I'll add is that, you know, I'm a journalist, and I, over the years, have learned a lot about where my food comes from. I did a podcast a few years ago for the Southern Foodways Alliance about the poultry industry, and now I have very specific poultry that I will eat as a result. So I've learned a lot as a result of being a journalist and also through this exploration, which was very personal.
So as a journalist, do you know, and also as a Puerto Rican, do you know what people are eating right now in Puerto Rico post Hurricane Maria? How have their foodways been affected?
You know, my understanding from my last conversations with friends and colleagues, and I should say most of my family is on the U.S. mainland, and my family that I'm closest to in Puerto Rico is my cousin Itegue, who is vegan, and her kids are vegan. So I know that they're probably still eating produce and coconuts and plantains and things like that. You know, what I can say is that in the early moments after the hurricane, Puerto Rico was thrust back into a subsistence way of eating that I think is really familiar for a lot of Puerto Ricans. Lots of canned things, lots of prepackaged things. And now I'd like to think that things are starting to shift. There's been a big movement for a renewal of agriculture by younger farmers in recent years. And I imagine that they are right back into redeveloping their crops.
And so things have turned around. Things are turning around. Things are growing again. Things are...
I'd like to hope so. Yeah, I mean, I have sort of anecdotal information from my friends, but I was talking to a colleague the other day, and they're like, oh, my mom told me that the mango tree that was in her yard that was totally stripped has 7 leaves on it now.
Right.
You know, so I'm hearing anecdotal things like that. But, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done in Puerto Rico. I think it would be inaccurate to say that people are doing really well there. There's, I think, a lot of work has gone into it, but I'm happy to be a small part of keeping Puerto Rico in the headlines because the repairs are really endless and hurricane season just started all over again.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Vaughn, on that note, thank you for joining us. Your book, Coconuts and Collards, is available anywhere books are sold, and it was great to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
I'm Melissa Clark, and we've been speaking with Vaughn Diaz about her new book, Coconuts and Collards, Recipes and Stories from Puerto Rico to the Deep South. On July 21st, Vaughn Diaz will be signing copies of her book at the Grow New York Green Market stand in Union Square. Come meet her. She's lovely.